program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. We will start today with an article from the Ideas section of the July 2025 magazine. This article is entitled, What Happened When Hitler Took on Germany's Central Banker? This was written by Timothy W. Ryback. Hans Luther was the principled and respected president of the Reichsbank, but he wouldn't accede to Hitler's demands. Adolf Hitler's first weeks as chancellor were filled with so many excesses and outrages, crushing states' rights, curtailing civil liberties, intimidating opponents, rewriting election laws, raising tariffs, that it was easy to overlook one of his targets, the German Central Bank. The Reichsbank president was a man named Hans Luther, a fiscal conservative who subscribed to the golden rule of banking, which stipulated that a country's indebtedness should never exceed its obligations. In his adherence to protocol and policy, Luther could be, quote, holier than the Pope, end quote, according to Lutz Schwerin von Krosigk, who served as the German finance minister from 1932 to 1945. On the afternoon of Monday, January 30th, 1933, just hours after Hitler's appointment as chancellor, Luther stood in Hitler's office with a complaint. Nazi stormtroopers, known as the SA, had forced their way into the Reichsbank building in central Berlin, despite what Luther described as emphatic protests by bank personnel, and hoisted a swastika flag over the bank. I pointed out to Hitler that the SA actions were against the law, Luther recalled, to which Hitler immediately answered that this was a revolution. Luther informed Hitler in no uncertain terms that the Reichsbank was not part of his revolution. It was an independent fiscal entity with an international board of directors. If any flag were to be flying over the bank, it would be the national colors, not the banner of his political party. The next morning, the swastika was gone. On Hitler's first full day in office, rumors circulated that he wanted Luther gone. Alfred Kleefoth, the charge d'affaires at the United States Embassy in Berlin, dispatched a memorandum to the State Department. I have been informed, in confidence, by Dr. Ritter, the chief economist in the Foreign Office, that the new government intends to exert pressure on Dr. Luther to resign. The Social Democratic daily Vorwärts declared in a banner headline that the Hitler government was demanding Luther's head. Hitler's rumored plans to oust the Reichsbank chief came amid a massive purge of the Weimar Republic civil service. Senior officials who had served for decades were fired. Hitler assigned his chief lieutenant, Hermann Göring, to clean house in Prussia, the largest of Germany's 17 federated states. When Göring entered the Prussian government offices in central Berlin, he told Rudolf Diels, the head of the Prussian political police, I want nothing to do with the scoundrels sitting here in this building. When Diels tried to defend one senior colleague, Göring responded by firing the colleague on the spot. A memorandum was circulated to all state civil servants demanding blind loyalty to the Hitler government. Anyone who did not feel they could support Hitler and his policies, Göring added, should do the honorable thing and resign. The Berliner Morgenpost observed that Hitler was clearly working to, quote, transform the state bureaucracy from the most senior positions down to the administrative levels to align with his political positions, end quote. In a speech on March 11th, Goring compared the Nazis' draconian measures to cutting wood. When you chop, chips fly. Despite Hitler's heavy-handed assault on the government bureaucracy, he could not touch Hans Luther. According to a 1924 law, the Reichsbank was independent of the elected government. The Reichsbank president served at the discretion of a 14-member board, which included 7 international bankers and economists. Even Reich President Paul von Hindenburg, the ultimate constitutional authority, possessed the power only to confirm the appointment of the Reichsbank president, not to dismiss him. The Reich president headed the state and commanded the military, and the Reich chancellor ran the government, but the Reichsbank controlled the currency and the economy. Luther brandished his independence and power with confidence and control. He had already served as finance minister and had also done a stint as chancellor. He understood both politics and economics. In 1923, Luther had designed the rescue plan that saved Germany from the inflation crisis that saw Germans pushing wheelbarrows full of cash through the streets to buy a loaf of bread. After the global market crash of 1929, he had guided Germany back to employment stability and production growth by the spring of 1932. Great Britain emerged from the crisis with twice the national debt of Germany. France's was fourfold. The New York Times reported that Luther had stood like a rock amid the global financial turmoil. The newspaper Vossische Zeitung described Luther as equal to any storm. Finance Minister Krosigk attributed the Reichsbank president's success in stabilizing the economy to Luther's intelligence, his clear-sightedness, his extraordinary work ethic, his common sense, and his energy. Luther was firm in his principles and policies, and he believed in meeting international obligations. But he was cautious with his pronouncements. As a central banker, Luther knew that a single word or even a smirk or smile could send markets tumbling. On Wednesday, November 23, 1932, Luther had been invited to address a group of industrialists and businessmen in the city of Dusseldorf, in the country's industrial heartland, along with the jurist and political philosopher Carl Schmitt. Schmitt was already renowned as the most eloquent political theorist and advocate of authoritarianism in Germany. Known as the crown jurist of the Third Reich, Schmitt would later supply legal justification for Hitler's Night of the Long Knives in 1934 and for the anti-Semitic Nuremberg Laws of 1935. On that November Wednesday in 1932, Luther listened in dismay as Schmitt laid out his arguments for the Hitler system of authoritarian rule, which included ending representative government and parliamentary rule, as well as the eradication of political parties, press freedoms, due process, and rule of law in favor of total dictator. Luther was appalled. From the first and only time in his career as Reichsbank president, Luther took a public political stance. Speaking after Schmitt, he argued that a functioning economy required democratic structures and processes, and that industrialists and businessmen were duty-bound to support constitutional democracy. "We all bear the responsibility," Luther said, arguing that it was in everyone's interest, financial, social, and political, to support the Weimar Republic's constitutional democracy and rule of law. "I believe that the private sector, in particular, has a tremendous interest in emphasizing the necessity of legal security across the board," Luther said, "because legal stability is the foundation of all economic life." That same month, Luther cautioned Chancellor Franz von Papen against experiments with the recovering German economy. I told Dr. Luther that if he was not prepared to accept the risks involved, Papen later recalled, the government would be obligated to disregard his advice. Within a month, Papen was out as chancellor. Papen's successor, Kurt von Schleicher, encountered similar resistance. When Schleicher informed his cabinet that his government would seek a 2.7 billion Reichsmark credit line, he received a chastening reply, as recorded in the cabinet minutes. The Reich Minister of Economics, who had also participated in the meeting with the president of the Reichsbank, declared that, based on all experiences in negotiations with the Reichsbank, further commitments would probably not be possible. Schleicher's government fell within the month. By the time Hitler assumed the chancellorship, Luther had already outlasted three chancellors, and there was reason to believe that Hitler could be the fourth. However much Hitler might want to remove Luther from his post, Vossische Zeitung reported, existing legal frameworks make this hardly possible. But that still left extra legal frameworks. Luther knew all too well about these. Months earlier, on the evening of April 9, 1932, Luther had been shot by two assailants in the Potsdam train station in central Berlin. According to the court record, the attackers intended to, quote, slightly wound, end quote, Luther, which they succeeded in doing, as a protest against currency policies they believed were wrong and damaging to the German people. Although the court said it could not rule on Luther's currency policies, it did sentence the two assailants to 10 months in prison for their choice of means in expressing their policy objections. Following the meeting about the swastika banner on his first day as chancellor, Hitler did not see Luther for 6 weeks. Instead, Hitler returned for economic guidance to Luther's predecessor at the Reichsbank, Hjalmar Schacht. The former central banker had become a key Hitler ally in the financial world, seeking to rally bankers and industrialists behind the Nazi government. Kleefoth, the U.S. embassy chargé, dined with Schacht shortly after Hitler ascended to the chancellorship. Schacht took pains to impress me with the fact that he is Hitler's financial and economic advisor, and that he is constantly in consultation with the new chancellor, Kleefoth reported. Kleefoth further noted that Schacht had told him German industrialists were backing Hitler and his program. I have good reason to believe, however, that this statement is an exaggeration, Kleefoth reported in a subsequent memo to the State Department. A leading executive official of the Reichsverband der Deutschen Industrie told me only this morning that the four-year plan announced by Hitler last night was an absurdity, and that his organization viewed the latest political developments with skepticism and reserve. Only after national elections on March 5th, when National Socialists secured 44% of the electorate and a mandate to move forward with a major rearmament program, did Hitler again summon Luther to the chancellery. Hitler admitted that he'd been compelled to meet with Luther because, given that the government was already running significant budget deficits, it would have been completely impossible to begin the work of rearmament without substantial funds from the Reichsbank. After spending 2 hours explaining to Luther the need for expanded military capacities, Hitler asked him how much financing the Reichsbank would be able to make available. In response, Luther assured Hitler that, as a nationally minded man, he appreciated Hitler's intentions and would be willing to provide 100 million Reichsmark, not even 1/20th of the billions Hitler had requested. Hitler was stunned. He thought he had misheard, so he repeated his question. Luther gave the same answer. He later observed that, beyond the gross violation of Germany's international debt obligations the Chancellor was calling for, Hitler's preparations for mass murderous poison of war were not in Luther's medicine cabinet of remedies for the German economy. Hitler informed President Hindenburg that he wanted Luther removed as head of the Reichsbank. Hindenburg reminded Hitler that the Reichsbank was an internationally governed institution and thus beyond the reach of German authority. So once again, Hitler summoned Luther to the Reich Chancellery. At his first meeting with Hitler, back in January, Luther had been struck by Hitler's apparent moderation. The Chancellor was not the ranting, raging fanatic, the abnormal man depicted in press accounts. 6 weeks later, that moderation was gone. Although it was becoming ever clearer to Luther that Hitler was going to make it impossible for him to carry out his fiduciary duties to the government, Luther used the occasion to remind Hitler of the Reichsbank's independence and his own immunity from dismissal. Hitler acknowledged that, as Chancellor, he did not have the legal power to remove Luther as central banker. But, he told Luther bluntly, as the new boss of the country, he had access to considerable alternative sources of power that he would not hesitate to employ ruthlessly against Luther if the interest of the state demanded it. The nature of Hitler's threats was unmistakable. Luther, who had already been shot once before in protest of his monetary policies, did not need to be warned again. On March 16th, Luther submitted his resignation to the Reichsbank board. In an extended letter to Hindenburg, Luther explained his reasons for stepping down. Luther reminded Hindenburg that the leadership of the Reichsbank must be stable and independent of partisan political currents, that a change in political parties, directions, and majorities must not in itself result in a change in the leadership of the Reichsbank. Luther also reminded Hindenburg that he had served as Reichsbank president alongside three previous governments. Nevertheless, Luther continued, it had become clear to him that the strained relationship between the Reichsbank and the current government was not sustainable and would only damage the country and its economy. But Luther insisted to Hindenburg that his resignation was contingent on the assurance that, quote, an independent Reichsbank must be preserved for the sake of the German state, its people, and its economy, end quote. The Berliner Morgenpost, like many mainstream newspapers, lamented the departure of the man whose strict fiscal policy had twice rescued Germany from economic ruin. The New York Times observed that regulatory safeguards designed to secure the independence of the Reichsbank proved to be wholly illusory with the current administration. Under the pressure of the kind in which the National Socialists are adept at applying, the Times wrote, even high government officials in Germany do not now try to retain their posts. Amid the turmoil of his wrangling with Luther, Hitler had summoned Hjalmar Schacht to the Reich Chancellery, where he posed to Schacht the same question he had asked Luther. How much did Schacht think the Reichsbank could provide in helping finance the Hitler's government's plans? Schacht dodged the question. Giving a precise amount was impossible, Schacht said. You must be able to tell me to what degree the Reichsbank can or should provide assistance, Hitler pressed. Herr Reich Chancellor, Schacht said, I really cannot give you a specific amount. Too many factors existed when it came to a massive rearmament program. But Schacht assured Hitler of one thing, that the Reichsbank would provide Hitler with as much money as he needed. Hitler paused. He studied Schacht in silence, then added, would you be willing to resume the leadership of the Reichsbank? Schacht assumed office the same day Luther departed. The writer Timothy W. Ryback is a historian and director of the Institute for Historical Justice and Reconciliation in The Hague. He is the author of several books on Hitler's Germany, most recently, Takeover, Hitler's Final Rise to Power. Our second story is A Love Letter to Music Listings, written by Gabriel Kahane. About a year and a half ago, I was scheduled to play a concert in Vermont when word came that the gig would be canceled because of an approaching nor'easter. I checked out of the hotel early, lobbed my suitcase into a rental car, and hightailed it to New York as menacing clouds darkened the rearview mirror. Brooklyn had been home for the better part of two decades, but after a move to the Pacific Northwest, I was returning as a tourist, and the show's cancellation augured a rare free evening in the city. There was just one problem. How was I going to figure out what to do with my night on the town? This used to be easy. You grabbed the New Yorker, the New York Times, Time Out New York, or the Village Voice, and checked out the event listings. When I graduated from college and moved to the city in 2003, Time Out quickly became my Bible, syllabus, and roadmap. The listings guided me through the cobweb bowels of St. Mark's Church and into the ontological hysteric theater hidden within, where Richard Foreman's mind-bending plays made an indelible impression on me. The listings brought me to Southpaw to hear Nico Case's bloodshot voice, to the Village Vanguard for Jason Moran or Paul Motian, and to a tin-ceiling basement bar in Park Slope, where I saw a baby-faced Sharon Van Etten sing her earliest songs and then bashfully hand out CDs burned with her demos, rich with high-frequency hiss from the tape deck onto which she'd recorded them. But over the past decade, event listings have all but disappeared. The New York Times killed its weekly arts listings at the end of 2016, and its online arts and entertainment guide remains frozen, like a butterfly pinned and dried, in March 2020. New York arts institutions closed because of coronavirus, reads the top headline. The Village Voice folded in 2018. The New Yorker's goings-on about town section was slashed in 2023 to just a page or two, now offering one recommendation per discipline. And Time Out, that veritable doorstop of weekly listings, now previews one or two concerts a month. This is in part a familiar story about declining ad revenue, about changing pressures and priorities in the journalism business. When listings began to disappear, many imagined that the internet would simply fill the void, that artists and their fans, as well as nonprofit institutions and their audiences, would find new ways to connect. But a world in which clicks are dollars has led to an Ouroboros of cultural journalism in which it is already what is already popular must be written about, which increases its popularity, which means it must be written about, which increases its popularity. And a social media ecosystem in which artists, no longer able to rely on legacy media for visibility, must create content to please an algorithm instead of their fans or themselves. As mainstream culture grows ever narrower, once robust subcultures are struggling for survival. Perhaps social media influencers are today's critics and curators, but even as our feeds promise discovery, they mostly serve us what we already like. We have no idea what we're missing. The listings were my lodestar, and that star's orbit was maintained, at least in part, by a journalist named Steve Smith. Smith was the music editor at Time Out New York from 2001 to 2014. He'd gotten his start at a classical radio station in Houston, introducing Brahms symphonies by day and playing in a rock band in biker bars, he was the drummer, by night. This stylistic mishmash would become a trademark of his sensibility. When we spoke last month, Smith mentioned Karlheinz Stockhausen, The Clash, Billy Idol, John Zorn, John Coltrane, Scandinavian Metal, Kronos Quartet, Kiss, Steve Reich, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and Beethoven, all within the first 10 minutes of our conversation. Time Out was a magazine that was basically nothing but the listings, Smith told me. Nobody said, oh, that obscure thing that's happening on a loading dock in Tribeca? No, that's too weird. I was basically told, list what's interesting, list what people will want to know about. A coveted red asterisk denoted a critic's pick. I had the privilege, he said, of making a difference in the lives of a number of composers and performers. And that, to me, was the most gratifying piece of the job. One of the lives he changed was mine. The first review I ever received as a singer-songwriter was written by Smith for his blog, Night After Night. The morning after the story ran, Lincoln Center called my manager and offered me a debut on its American Songbook performance series. Who reviewed the concert for the Times? None other than Steve Smith. To look at a page of event previews was to understand how a collection of artists related to one another. This, according to opera critic Olivia Giovetti, was one of Smith's greatest gifts as an editor. He crafted listings in such a way that drew out and illuminated the connections between artists so that the reader came to understand if they enjoyed a victory show at Les Poissons Rouges, they might also dig a Miss Music concert at Rockwood Music Hall. The loss of listings is, in this sense, the loss of a whole world, which historians, too, will have to contend with. For now, Smith is serving as a secretary, a minute keeper, the town historian for the creative music community in New York. After Time Out, he spent 2 years at the Boston Globe as an arts editor, then bounced between various jobs covering music back in the city, including a 5-year stint writing listings for The New Yorker. He's now a copyright writer at an arts institution. Still, he maintains a Substack newsletter, Night After Night, which shares the name of his old blog, the one on which he gave me my first review. Each week, Smith compiles a roundup of notable events in music that lives beyond that narrow mainstream. When I asked him when he returned to writing listings, he said, I never really stopped. I'm sorry, I had to severely edit that last article because we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.